Welcome back to Mechanical Dreams, the podcast where we decode the intricate machinery of machine learning and natural language processing. I'm Professor Norris, and as always, I'm joined by my brilliant student, Linda. How are things on the research front, Linda?
Doing great, Professor. I am incredibly excited about the paper I brought in today. It is called Why Larger Models Learn More, Effects of Capacity, Interference, and Rare Task Retention by a team of researchers from Stanford, Harvard, MIT, and Anthropic. It tackles a fundamental question that we all just sort of accept but rarely explain at a mechanistic level. Why exactly do larger models learn tasks that smaller ones completely fail at?
That is the $100 million question given today's compute budgets. But isn't the standard dogma just a matter of capacity and expressivity? A bigger brain can memorize more facts. Plus, the classic scaling laws from Kaplan and Chinchilla tell us that large models are simply more sample efficient. They ride the power law curve to a lower loss faster than small models.
That is exactly the intuition this paper challenges. They argue it's not just about sample efficiency. They propose a phenomenological argument. Even if you give a smaller model infinite data training in an asymptotic regime, it will still fundamentally fail to learn rare or complex tasks that a larger model picks up easily. They make a sharp distinction between loss reduction that is learnable via data scaling versus learnable via model scaling.
Wait, infinite data and it still fails? Now you have my attention. I'm naturally a bit skeptical when we casually dismiss sample efficiency, but if there's a fundamental optimization bottleneck, I want to hear the math. Surely a small model has the theoretical expressivity to represent the solution if we just post-train it, right?
Spot on. The authors explicitly point out that expressivity is not the issue here. We know from post-training literature that small models can indeed be fine-tuned to represent these tasks. Instead, the failure is all about the learning dynamics under gradient-based optimization when training on a massive data mixture.
So you're saying that during pre-training, the data mixture itself is somehow conspiring against the smaller model's gradient updates. It sounds like the model is being forced to choose what to care about.
Exactly. The paper takes a very data-centric view of scaling. They hypothesize that there is a regime where a small model fails to learn parts of a data mixture, specifically the rare or highly complex parts, simply because of how it is forced to allocate its limited parameters to the most frequent tasks in the dataset.
Ah, the classic problem of being overwhelmed by the common case. This sounds like a fascinating intersection of learning dynamics and dataset statistics. Let's dive into the details to see how they actually prove this statistical bottleneck exists. At the end of the last chapter, we established that small models get overwhelmed by the common case and fail to learn rare tasks, even with infinite data. So how do the authors actually prove this bottleneck? I'm guessing they didn't just train a massive language model and stare at the loss curves hoping for an epiphany.
You know it. To really isolate the mechanics, they built a highly controlled synthetic setup. They created a multitask learning environment using a mixture of K-linear regression tasks. By using a toy model, they could perfectly track how the network allocates its internal resources.
Ah, a toy model. I love a good toy model. It strips away the chaotic noise of modern deep learning and lets us see the actual gears turning. So what makes one task different from another in this regression setup?
Two main properties, frequency and complexity. Frequency is straightforward. It is just how often a task appears in the training data mixture. But complexity is where it gets interesting. They define complexity by how slowly the spectrum of a task's feature matrix decays.
Let me make sure I follow. If the spectrum decays slowly, it means the variance is spread out. The task requires more distinct orthogonal directions or features to produce the correct target output.
Exactly. A simple task might just rely on one or two dominant directions, but a complex task requires combining many features. To ensure they could observe exactly how the model allocates its parameters, which we can think of as bottleneck neurons, they designed the tasks to occupy orthogonal blocks. There is no inherent overlap in the optimal features between tasks.
I see. Since the tasks are orthogonal, the model cannot cheat by sharing representations. It has to make a hard choice about which tasks to dedicate its limited bottleneck neurons to. How does it make that choice? Is it just a popularity contest based on frequency?
Basically, yes, but they formalized it beautifully. The paper proves a theorem that features are learned in a strict order of what they call utility. They define utility mathematically as the task's frequency multiplied by the eigenvalue of that specific feature.
Ah, that is very elegant. So a feature's utility is high if it belongs to a task that shows up all the time, or if it explains a huge amount of variance within its own task.
Right. So high frequency or low complexity means high utility. The optimal encoder will always prioritize retaining the features with the largest utility. If you're a small model with limited width, you're going to spend all your budget on those top-tier high-utility features.
Let's dig into that math for a second. If utility is frequency times eigenvalue, then a rare task needs to have a massive eigenvalue just to compete with the long tail of a highly frequent task's features. That's a brutal economy.
It really is. If a rare task makes up, say, 0.25% of the observations, its most important foundational feature might still have lower utility than the fifth or sixth most important feature of a highly frequent task. The model will literally prefer to learn nuanced, lower-order modes of a common task rather than the most basic concept of a rare task.
It's like a student cramming for an exam by only studying the topics that show up 90% of the time and diving deep into the trivia of those topics while completely ignoring the chapters that only show up on the test occasionally. By the time the small model tries to learn a rare task, its neurons are fully occupied. Did they verify this empirically?
They did, and the results are striking. They trained student models of varying widths on a mixture of 32 regression tasks using a power law distribution for both task frequencies and feature spectra. They plotted a phase diagram showing which features were retained as a function of model width and task frequency.
Let me guess, it perfectly matched the analytic prediction, a beautiful staircase pattern where increasing width predictably unlocks the next tier of lower utility features. You guessed it, the empirical loss curve tightly matched their analytic prediction across different task setups. Increasing width preferentially improves the low frequency tasks, simply because the model finally has enough budget to retain those lower utility features without sacrificing the common ones. That makes perfect sense for a static capacity constraint, but I'm still hung up on the infinite time aspect we teased earlier. Even if the utility is low, once the high utility features are learned, the model will eventually encounter a rare task. The gradients will point towards those rare features. Why doesn't gradient descent just nudge the weights to squeeze it in over time?
It absolutely tries to. When the model sees a rare task, the parameters do update. But that brings us right to the edge of our next topic, gradient interference. The statistical bottleneck isn't just about what fits in memory at the end of the day. It's about the strict pecking order enforced by gradient descent step by step.
A stark reminder that in neural networks, the frequent get richer and the rare get completely ignored. Let's move on to the mechanics of that interference. All right, Linda, you left us hanging. You said when the model sees a rare task, the parameters do update. So why doesn't the model just slowly accumulate that knowledge over infinite time?
Because of what happens between those rare sightings. Let us picture a small model that just processed a batch containing our rare task. The gradients say, hey, move this way to learn this new feature. And the model does. We see a spike in the rare task's signal.
So far, so good. But I'm guessing the very next batch is full of high-frequency tasks.
Exactly. And because the small model is starved for capacity, those rare features are sharing the exact same neurons as the low utility features of the frequent tasks. So the frequent tasks scream, we still have residual error to fix. Change those weights back. And the model overwrites the rare task updates.
Ah, it's a constant cycle of learning and immediately forgetting. It's like trying to build a sandcastle right at the tide line. Every time you scoop some sand, the waves wash it away before you can build the next layer.
That is a perfect analogy, Professor. The authors call this the update and forget loop. In their paper, they formalize this by looking at local stability. A rare feature can only displace a common feature and become locally stable if its utility is higher than the weakest occupied common task utility. If it's lower, the frequent task will always claw that space back.
It's micro-scale catastrophic forgetting happening continuously during pre-training. But wait, how does making the model wider or giving it more parameters actually fix the tide? Doesn't the frequent task still want to update?
This is where the math gets really beautiful. They introduce a concept called residual controls learning. When you widen the model, you give it enough resources to fully capture the high utility features of the common tasks. As those common tasks get learned perfectly, their residual error shrinks.
And because the gradient is proportional to the residual error, the gradient updates for the common tasks become weak.
Yes, the aggregate common task gradient is bounded by the residual signal. Once the width crosses a critical threshold, the model has allocated enough parameters to the frequent tasks that their gradients essentially quiet down. They stop violently overwriting the rare task features.
So the larger model builds a quiet, stable foundation for the common tasks. The waves recede, allowing the faint, infrequent signals from the rare tasks to slowly accumulate over time. Did they test this accumulation empirically?
They did a brilliant experiment to isolate this retention effect. They used a matched frequency injection protocol. They withheld the rare task for a specific gap of G steps and then injected a batch of rare tasks all at once, ensuring the overall global frequency remained exactly the same.
Clever. By concentrating the rare tasks, they can measure exactly how long the memory of that batch survives the barrage of frequent tasks.
Exactly. They tracked the rare task signal dynamically. In narrow models, the signal spikes at the injection step, but decays rapidly back to near zero during the gap. It's that update and forget loop. But in larger models, the signal remains stable across the gap. After each injection, the larger model accumulates the signal, stair-stepping its way up until the task is fully learned.
That fundamentally changes how we think about memorization and scaling. We usually think of memorization as overfitting, but here, the capacity to retain a faint memory across thousands of noisy gradient steps is the absolute prerequisite for learning the rare task at all.
It really is. Scaling provides the representational slack necessary to reduce gradient interference. It buys the rare task's time to consolidate into a learned abstraction.
That is a very compelling theoretical argument. But you know me, Linda. Linear algebra and toy regression models are wonderful, but the title of this podcast isn't Matrix Dreams. We need to know if this actually happens in a real large language model.
Do not worry, Professor. The authors took these exact hypotheses and tested them on a real 1 billion parameter language model pre-training pipeline. We can dive into those results next.
So, Linda, at the end of the last chapter, you promised me we would leave the comfortable world of linear algebra and see if these beautiful theories hold up in the messy reality of large language models. How did the authors test this?
They went all out. They used the ALMO framework to train a series of transformer models ranging from a tiny 4 million parameters all the way up to a respectable 4 billion parameters. And they trained them on the Dalma corpus, which is a massive standard pre-training dataset.
A standard pre-training setup. Excellent. But here is the problem. To test our statistical bottleneck theory, we need to precisely control the frequency of a rare task. You can't exactly do that with natural language. How do you know how often a model sees a specific type of reasoning in a terabyte of web scrape?
That is exactly the hurdle they had to overcome. To solve it, they'd adopted a data injection framework borrowed from the memorization literature. They created two completely novel synthetic tasks that the model would definitely not see in the natural Dalma data, and they injected them into the training stream at strictly controlled frequencies.
Ah, an intervention. I love a good controlled experiment. What were the synthetic tasks?
They used a comparison task and a modular addition task. Both were encoded as a sequence of three tokens. For the comparison task, the model had to learn a secret bijective mapping where random vocab words were assigned a hidden integer value from 0 to 99 and then predict a label token indicating which of the two inputs was larger.
So it might see something like apple, banana, cat. And cat is the label for true, meaning apple's hidden value is less than banana's. That is wonderfully absurd, ensuring the model can't rely on prior knowledge.
Exactly. The paper gives an example like address, analyze, pony, where pony represents true. And for the modular addition task, it had to predict the token whose hidden value equaled the sum of the first two tokens, modulo 100. Critically, solving these requires learning a geometric structure to generalize to unseen combinations. It is not just rote memorization.
Modular addition, the classic grokking task. Okay, so they have these synthetic tasks. At what frequencies did they inject them?
They varied the injection frequency from roughly one instance per batch to one instance every 10 batches. And Professor, the behavioral results perfectly mirrored the toy regression setup. Only the larger Olmo models were able to learn the infrequent tasks. The smaller models completely failed, plateauing at random chance on the evaluation set.
And what about the learning order? Did the Olmo models learn tasks strictly based on their frequency utility, just like the toy model predicted?
Yes, they did. They tracked the injected tasks alongside naturally occurring reference arithmetic tasks from the pre-training data. Across all runs, tasks were learned strictly in the order of their frequency. The more frequent a task, the earlier the loss dropped. But here's the kicker. On the modular addition task, only the larger Olmo models trained on the highest frequencies exhibited grokking.
Wait, grokking? Inside a standard language model pre-training run?
Yes. We usually only see grokking in sterile, isolated algorithmic datasets. But here, they observed it in the middle of training a massive language model on web text. The training loss on the injected task would drop, and then, much later, the evaluation accuracy would suddenly spike. And it only happened if the model had enough capacity.
That is phenomenal. It proves that the abstract representation takes time to build, and only a large enough model has the spare width to sustain that building process without the frequent data crushing it. Speaking of which, did they test the retention effect in Olmo, the gap between rare observations?
They absolutely did. They replicated the matched frequency experiment. For instance, they compared injecting one instance every batch versus injecting 100 instances every 100 batches. The total global frequency is identical, but the gap between updates is huge in the second scenario.
Let me guess. The larger the gap, the worse the model performed, because the rare task gradients get overwritten by the language modeling gradients during those 100 batches.
Nailed it! Models trained with larger gaps between task instances had significantly higher task loss. The memory of the task literally decays if the gap is too wide, unless the model is exceptionally large. In fact, they showed that given the same compute budget, larger models achieve lower task loss specifically because they're more compute efficient at retaining these low-frequency tasks.
So, the update and forget loop is undeniably real, even when you're training a 4 billion parameter transformer on hundreds of billions of tokens. It's quite a vindication of their initial phenomenological argument. But I know you, Linda, and I know this paper. They didn't just stop at loss curves, did they?
Not at all. To definitively prove the gradient interference theory, they cracked the models open to look at the internal representations and the batch gradients themselves. But maybe we should save that mechanistic evidence for our final chapter.
A perfect cliffhanger. Let's dig into the mechanistic interpretability right after this.
All right, we are back. Linda, before the break, you promised me we were going to look under the hood of these billion-parameter transformers. How did the researchers prove this gradient interference is actually happening inside the Olmo models?
First, they had to prove the models were actually learning the structural abstractions of the tasks, not just memorizing the training batches. For the comparison task, they used a technique called distributed alignment search, or DAS, to locate a one-dimensional subspace in the first layer's residual stream that causally encoded the global token order.
Impressive. And for the modular addition task? We know from earlier mechanistic interpretability work that models usually solve that using circular mathematical representations.
Exactly. They measured the presence of Fourier modes across the layers. For both tasks, they found that larger models and models trained on higher frequencies embedded significantly more of these abstract causal features into their representations.
Okay, so the structural features are definitively there, but what about the update and forget loop? Did they catch the language modeling gradients crushing the rare task gradients in the act?
They did. They isolated the top neurons in the first layer MLP that implemented the comparison task. Then they compared the gradient updates coming from the injected task tokens against the gradients coming from the standard high-frequency language modeling tokens in the batch.
Let me guess. In the small models, the language modeling gradients were stomping all over the rare task updates.
Precisely. In the 20 million parameter model, the batch gradients were oscillating wildly, meaning the non-task tokens were causing random, destructive collisions with the task direction. But in the 1 billion parameter model, the non-task gradients were almost entirely orthogonal to the task direction. The gradient interference basically vanished.
That is the smoking gun right there. Scaling up creates enough high-dimensional space for these orthogonal directions to coexist peacefully. The massive language modeling updates don't crush the fragile rare task updates.
Exactly. Which leads us to the final practical takeaway of the paper, a data-centric view of scaling. It suggests that if we want a model to learn a specific rare capability, we do not always have to scale up the parameter count.
Right. If you understand this statistical bottleneck, you can just intentionally upsample that rare task in your data mixture. You can overcome the interference in a smaller model by artificially increasing the task's utility to force the model to dedicate neurons to it.
Exactly. It also completely reframes memorization. Memorizing those rare instances across batches isn't overfitting. It is a fundamental prerequisite. The model has to hold on to those specific examples long enough for the generalizable abstractions, like those Fourier modes, to slowly accumulate.
A fantastic paper, Linda. It bridges the gap between theoretical scaling laws and the messy reality of data mixtures perfectly. Thank you for bringing it in. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Mechanical Dreams. Keep exploring and try not to overwrite your rare task features before next week.